in action, where we've seen either within Quantium or around the world how various governments and businesses are using big data, and then of course the challenges that are involved in using big data in a proper manner. So to start with, in order to understand big data, we need to realise that this actually encompasses a number of new technologies that are coming to the fore. So we've got the internet, with around 80% internet penetration now in developed markets. We have something like 2 billion internet users globally expected by 2015. We have mobile technology, 1.3 billion mobile phones shipped globally in 2010. We have social media, also storing big data. There are 600 million Facebook users with something like 40 billion photos stored in Facebook alone. It would take, I think someone estimated, about 1,000 years for any one person to watch all the videos on YouTube. The cloud is another new thing. I don't know how many people are using it. I don't actually use it that much, but Amazon Cloud houses more than 260 billion objects. And Netflix takes up 20% of the total US web bandwidth from between 8 to 10 p.m. every night. Then we have the concept of the Internet of Things. We have over 1 trillion connected devices by 2015 estimated, and 30% of mobile data subs to use augmented reality by weekly by 2012, or what they expected by 2012. To put it all in context, we have the example of Walmart. Walmart collects information about all its consumers on a daily basis, collects 2.5 petabytes of data every hour, which is equivalent, a petabyte is equivalent to about 20 million filing cabinets worth of text. So that's, I mean, storage is becoming a bigger issue than even collecting data at this point. So the world contains an unimaginable amount of data and it's growing at a rapid speed. But the key to understand is, with all of this growing data, how is it being used and is it being used smartly? Big data has many various definitions. Data Task Force at ADMA has used a commercial definition that suggests big data is the term given to a collection of digital, technological, and analog sources to improve businesses and understanding of markets, allowing an improvement of the customer experience and organizational performance. For us, I think, in short, it's a collection, analysis, and generation of insights from a variety of data sources. One of the biggest problems with all of the issues I said, with many, many petabytes of data, is we're progressing quite fast along with collecting large volumes of data to dump data. Collecting data and not analysing it doesn't really lead to any kind of useful analysis. The sheer volume of data is creating a revolution that, in a way, the data is used and stored, but not necessarily in the way it's analysed and utilised appropriately. So we believe there's actually a shift or a danger to shift towards simply collecting data and pulling in analytics rather than actually analysing data. So as volumes grow, it's crucial to understand the importance of using data in a smart way, and that can often involve using a smaller or medium data set. Current opinion around big data across various sources suggests the key way to identify a big data source or a good big data source is about volume, which we've already discussed, velocity, which is about data in motion. So speed of creation of data is sometimes even more important than the actual volume of data. The importance of real-time data is quite important for something like investment markets. For example, the MIT Media Lab used location data from mobile applications on Black Friday in the US to understand how big the start of the Christmas shopping season was. So they predicted from Macy's parking lot what sort of shopping behaviors were going to come through and the level to which, there'd be a competitive advantage to Macy's recorded sales. So this was long before Macy's even knew what their own recorded sales was. Gave a bunch of Wall Street analysts a serious advantage in terms of understanding where to invest. And then there's the concept of variety, data in many forms. One example is in Quantium, we use data sets across three different main partners, being Foxtel, NAB transactional data, and Woolworths. So the idea is to combine data sets to give more information, and those three things are generally understood to provide a good metric as to what's a good big data set. So commercial applications of data to create new value, we like to think of as going from the bottom left-hand corner there, where we have limited information and limited imagination, moving over time through data insights to an area with limitless information and unlimited imagination. One of the key, I'll just talk through a few examples of big data in use. One of the things that I personally find really interesting is the US government has apparently tracked or worked out a way of understanding whether someone is likely to be a terrorist or not based on the way you walk. So they'll capture the way you walk and your stance and posture and link it up to what they know to be dangerous walking styles to figure out where there's danger ahead. I'm not quite sure how they're using it. Another excellent example recently, Shazam, a website, they managed to predict based on people's preferences and song searches about 33 days before a song was a hit, Shazam will know that the song was going to be a hit. So clearly gives them a significant advantage. So, but data is also becoming, as a result of such advances, the biggest new board governance issue. There's some very smart minds thinking about data and how to run it. And if you're not ahead in this space, you probably get run over. Amazon.com, for example, has managed to use 30% of revenue from selling recommendations by its own customers, creating $1 billion in advertising from this source, which is just simply everyone in this room or anyone who's ever used Amazon putting through their recommendations. What we always say with, this encompasses, in Quantium a lot of activity. As Henry Ford said, if I had asked the public what they need, they would have asked for a faster horse. So a lot of big data use comes from the expertise of the person doing the analysis, understanding more about what they can do sometimes than even the business that you're trying to help knows. And I think actuaries can be placed in a pretty unique position with our skill set of software, commercial acumen, to understand the sort of leaps that can be taken and innovation that can happen that's not necessarily apparent. One of the key ideas that the data helps to solve is we say businesses often have a customer blind spot. Their best customers probably never fill in a survey, might never like them on social media, don't go to focus groups to complain, are not in an online panel, and don't search for them. So what they do, though, is that the detectors make us leave, and usually most businesses have no idea as to who the people are that are leaving and that were previously revenue generated. Another reason to use data rather than surveys, actual behaviors can often be understated or overstated in surveys. So for example, we have the example, it's so illustrated by me, but we have the example of a survey where people were asked how often they shop at a department store, and the answer was about 8.3% when the reality observed was about 3.3%. This is for women aged 18 to 64 in Melbourne. So we're talking about an overstatement of 152%, and if that's used to create strategies for marketing purposes, it can lead to some really wasted dollars. The other issue we find is over-reliance on generalized data. So these few traits that we have here are based largely on things that can be obtained from census information. A male in the UK, born in 1948, remarried, multiple kids, and fairly well educated. is usually a classification that many businesses, especially in retail, think is perfectly fine to classify people into groups and work out what to market to them. However, that could be Prince Charles or Aussie. And one would think that the advantage of big data and understanding customers is about knowing what each of those people prefer to shop when they shop. This is just an example of how wrong you can go with using low sources of information or census level. Sources of data can include internal and external data. We've put up what we have at Quantium from Woolworths and EDR, 7.5 million registered cardholders. Then we've got Foxtel, and which is media preferences, and then NAB, which of course tells us in a de-identified manner a longitudinal view of customers and how they spend over time. One of the ways that I thought would be useful to bring this to life is the impact of insurance. I hope is a topic that's familiar to most of the people in this room. The impact of challenger brands in New South Wales has been such that market share has doubled for them in the last few years. Now, this can be obtained from some very basic analysis, but where analysing big data comes in is understanding who are these people. So we look across demographics, customer geography, brand and category preferences, shopping behaviours, and other bespoke segmentations to understand more about who the people are that move towards challenges. We see that they're actually customers who are more skewed towards new and younger families. We see they're actually 1.3 times more likely to be new families or with new babies, and not at all likely to be the older singles and couples or even older families and retirees. So we see the sticky business is actually at the very young or the older end, and these people tend to be new families, possibly on new budgets. Another aspect is the newspaper and magazine preferences to bring to life who is the customer. That has the appeal of the challenger brand. From newspapers, we see 10% more likely to be Daily Telegraph or, Herald Sun readers, whereas they're 40% less likely to be reading the AFR. So that really gives a good idea of what sort of person it is that you're trying to target, and can definitely aid with media use and marketing for insurance. Similar story from the magazine side. They're not likely to be interested in Delicious magazine or Women's Weekly, interestingly, but they will be much more likely to use or read a woman's Day. The reason I sort of brought that up is that challenges are now having an impact in most customer segments. So we see over the years on the left-hand side, we have 2010, a map that shows if they were only starting to impact the south and sort of western regions of Sydney. That started taking over until 2014. We no longer have a geographical preference, or see these challenger brands are prevalent throughout. So where is the risk can also help identify how you have to tackle Quick read through on Market Blueprint. This is a transactional database that we obtained from NAB in a de-identified manner, but it gives us, we've just put up, I guess, a snapshot of what we see for about 202.5 million customers. It's literally their transactional set, and we will use that sort of information to understand the brands they shop with and how often. So it gives an indication of if someone's a pet lover, someone's had a new baby, and they'll shop more for baby stores, etc. Retail sales performance. One of the key things that we're able to do at Quantium is find out the sales performance about a month in advance of the ABS, and 99.5% correlated over more than 2 years, which gives, I guess, anyone who uses Market Blueprint information a pretty accurate understanding of what their customers are doing, and well in advance of what the general population sees 1 month later. some of the things that we're able to do is understand the online retail environment. So as an example, the 2014 story so far, proportion of online sales have gone up significantly in the last few years, nearly doubled. 6.6% of retail sales today are made online. Online sales growth is around 14% year on year, with roughly, we've got 15.2 billion for the 12 months to March 14. It's actually grown a little bit more since then. Two-thirds of Australians transacted with an online retailer in the year, with over 500,000 people new to online in the last year. So with these kind of stats that are useful, I guess it's perhaps not relevant to an insurance audience, but we're just trying to show a broader use. Some of the myths of online retail are that international brands are dominating online sales, that retirees are a slow-growing segment, that online spend in apparel is bigger than food and drink, and Sunday is the biggest online trading day. What data actually shows, and I apologize for the mixed up version, is that food and drink, despite having a lower proportion of spend online, is actually in dollar terms a much a bigger section than apparel, being worth across supermarkets and specialised food about $2.3 billion every year. Of all online spend, 26% is directed internationally, so it's not the dominant problem that it's often touted to be. Retirees are actually the fastest growing segment in online business. So what we find over time is that while there are a smaller proportion of spend online, this is growing at an alarming rate, and what we see is as generations grow with online and reach the older ages, they actually start spending more online as well. So with, you know, what used to be the perception that it's all about young, savvy people, not really the case. Australians spend more time online or shopping online at work than they do on weekends. It's quite interesting because there's much more important stuff online during the workday. So what this all leads to in terms of big data and all the opportunities that have been highlighted, I think what it comes down to is the data arms race, where businesses that are able to harness the big data and the analytics components to their advantage will necessarily get ahead and succeed in an increasingly competitive world. One of the examples is for M&A purposes. We had a recent example of a very large retailer, I might be able to say Woolworths. What they often do is use us to understand their customer base. So obviously there is an acquirer customer base and a target customer base. And what they might do is when they're looking at acquiring a new business, they will use us to understand who is their existing customer base and how many of those people are already shopping with the target or the acquiree. So that what they then understand is whether this new business offers them an expansion of the value proposition for or share a wallet of an existing group of people, or whether it's actually bringing them a whole new set of customers that they've not had transacting with them before. Now, given it's Woolworths, and pretty much everyone in Australia has transacted with Woolworths at some stage, one of the most interesting things I think that they viewed this as was how many people within our existing customer base look like, and this is done through modelling, but I use it loosely, look like people who transact with the target. So what they're trying to understand is if the target has a given offer, how much potential does their existing customer base then add to that and create value by being able to market to people who they already have on their books and sell them a wider offer or a range. So it really enabled them to go beyond what's normally done when with M&A deal banking, you know, if someone makes up a number generally. But here it was able to be validated with, you know, what they expected customers and customer base and loyalty can provide them. Another example that's increasingly being done is store network planning, optimizing store networks. An example is someone in the entertainment industry asked us a question around, here's our stores, and here are the better performers, and here's the worst performers. What can you tell us about who the better performers are? What sort of customers are making up the better performing stores? To give some context, it's a store because it's a video or DVD sort of store network. And what we were then able to do is actually say, well, we can give you an idea of what kind of customers are shopping with your stores, which was a completely opposite fit to what was expected. It was a much more affluent segment of the population than what this company was marketing to. And as a result, we were able to then say, well, which other areas in Australia where you don't have a store network should you be targeting, because they have a higher concentration of the kind of people that actually use your stores. And in the end, given the issues around their executives had a certain view that they actually should be targeting women at home and of a lower social demographic, to suddenly thinking, well, what we're telling them is actually the people who shop with you are people with kids, high income earners, and those with preferences of quality brands. Once they got past that initial stage, they've actually then taken on board all the recommendations that they're putting through stores, but in the areas that we suggested. But what that really does for them is gives them a clear competitive advantage in targeting the right set of customers as opposed to their competitors. Another example, data delivers a new lens to understanding markets and customers. So to build on that concept of online, on the left-hand side, we've got online customers versus offline customers. What we find is online customers tend to be younger singles and more premium in their preference. They'll shop with stores like David Jones and Peter's of Kensington, luxury boutiques, wine buffs, and frequent travellers. But what's really interesting is what's coming up on the right-hand side is that new online adopters, or people who've only started shopping online in the last year or two versus those who adopted early, actually tend to be more and more the average Aussie. They're people who shop, they tend to be smokers and drinkers, they're fast food junkies, their department store preferences include BW and cash converters. They'll shop at Donut King over most other food preferences. They tend to be more budget, and also there's a larger prevalence in older shoppers. So for any business that is trying to grow its online offering, understanding who that new online customer is invaluable. And the reason this is up here in a data arms race slide is that only a very small handful of online retailers actually know this. So the rest are at a disadvantage. Challenges with big data and its users. One of the key challenges is actually cultural. We still work in a business environment which adopts, I guess, what's commonly called now the HIPPO approach, highest paid person's opinion. And that's often in contradiction, and we've dealt with it in the entertainment example I explained earlier. Often it's about the top person's gut feel tells us this, and it doesn't matter what the data says. So that's a step to overcome and embrace technology. Technology in itself, despite being what enables big data, is often the biggest challenge. There's more data out there right now than can actually be stored. So all those 40 or 50 billion filing cabinets that Walmart has, they really do struggle in finding the storage space and to keep it and convert it into useful information. And then it's about collaboration. So in order to be useful, we often find big data actually has to be a number of different data sources being put together in a similar way that Quantium does, and that's in a few I guess places around the world that started to happen. But the difficulty is about actually getting a number of data partners together who will work together and generate more quality insights than just their data might give. So all in all, I think, in terms of where big data is, we're closer to the beginning of data analytics development than we are anywhere near to the end. It's considered the next frontier for innovation, competition, You know, you often get articles like Square, which are Silicon Valley's next great company. Walmart is targeting shoppers in the queue at Safeway with geo and time located ads. But all these things, every single day, you see more and more examples of big data coming through, and I think we're definitely at the start of the new revolution. What I say is, sort of 5 years from now, could we picture a consumer-facing business not using data? I find it very difficult because you'd be at such a competitive disadvantage if you didn't get on with it. Customer insights used to inform new market entry, I think, will become probably a standard. And media optimization and scale. So media is an area where big data is becoming increasingly used with contact touch points and understanding exactly who to contact becoming more and more crucial. Overall, I guess I found this interesting. The Harvard Business Review featured an article on the data scientist a little while back, the sexiest job of the 21st century. But the reason I've put it up here is I think that actuaries, regardless of what sort of area and which industry we work in, are quite uniquely placed with our software understanding, with our understanding of modelling techniques, predictive analysis, and the ability to turn data into numbers being something that we all work with, to actually embrace, either through career change or by actually considering in your individual jobs what external and internal data improvements can be made and what analytics can yield. I just think actuaries are in a great place to step into
what is starting to be the sexiest job of the century. Thanks.
Any questions? Or
well, in order to make it the sexiest job, you have to start with the source of data. I mean, most of the data that you talked about, sound all proprietary. And private, so that's not something that you can, access easily. Then my question is, that we will call internal data, but what about external data? What sort of external data can you get? And secondly, do they come at a cost?
Yeah.
So I'm assuming you may be able to get something from Google. Is that something you have to pay for, and how would you access them?
I think in terms of external data, you're absolutely right. The new developments in the industry are proprietary. Certainly at Quantium, we sell data insights, and they do come at a cost. Quantium isn't the only player in the market. There's a number of media players, so the likes of, I guess, Roy Morgan or any of the more, even more traditional data sources externally, other than maybe sensors, or some information that can be obtained is at a cost. But I think the cost compared with the advantage you can get from smartly using various sources of data and putting them together, that's where pulling together sensors, pulling together information from different sources and turning it into something that's then maybe, then proprietary to yourself is actually where the value is at, both for the data source and the users. But absolutely there's a cost.
The one bit where you mentioned that sometimes a company's best customers, they don't know anything about them, they don't put in surveys, they don't participate in forums, they don't recognize those sorts of don't put like, just don't do any of that.
Yep.
So, what are the implications of that? What can companies, what can they do about something like that?
I work at Quantium and I'm not going to try and push that side of it, but companies such as Quantium, who utilize big data, especially on the media side as well, what they can help you is understand and identify the customers who have left. So within Quantium, within Market Blueprint, we regularly do that for retailers, understanding your defectors and new customers. Who are they? What age groups are they? What kind of products would they be buying? Something then perhaps through loyalty cards, you can actually identify that yourself. But what then a business struggles with often is, despite the loyalty card and product behaviour, what they don't understand is this a mother with young children that's leaving? So in the last year, have young people stopped shopping with us? Or have we gained in another sector? So it's about understanding the changing customers, and often it's also about understanding the changing dynamics. So do people shop more often? For example, online, without giving away business information, overall online we find that average basket sizes are falling while people shop more and more often. So understanding those things and the trends can really help target both marketing and product offers.
Thanks, Suma. So can you give us some insights into where financial services companies are relative to, the Woolworths and, these others that are utilising data, and, why there is a difference, if they're not utilising to the same extent?
Yep.
What are some of the challenges maybe that they're facing?
Yeah. I actually don't think financial services, it's fair to say they're not utilising data. There are definitely some, but it tends to be focused on the larger players. I think there's an advantage given the costs involved. It does tend to be the larger players that are forced to then competitively think outside the square of what they've done traditionally. For example, insurers use data sources and various data sources quite vastly and efficiently. In many ways, and in competition with one another. So, and increasingly are looking at who, with the example of the challenger brands, are increasingly looking at who the people are that are leaving them, and understanding that for pricing purposes as well. So, across financial services, I'm not sure it's a fair comment to say that they're not using it, but I think the challenges for them are the same as everybody else. Often it comes to justifying the cost of additional analysis in terms of what benefits it's going to bring, but it's changing slowly, I think. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm jumping from a data analytic area to more traditional actuarial area at the moment, and one question I'm constantly struggling with is defining the penetration point to break the big data, or the concept of big data, or the mechanism, program, technology.
Yeah.
How does that fit into traditional actuarial work in insurance area in particular?
So I'm not sure I understand the first part of the question, but I'll answer. So I think it's similar to what I just said to Isma, in the sense that traditional actuarial work will teach us to use a GLM model to price various products in a certain way. Where adding the data layer comes in is about stepping outside that sort of square and understanding, well, what are the habits of these people outside? So if you are able to understand what newspapers your best customers prefer, that gives a very simplistic understanding of where you might market your product. So it's about a holistic view rather than, I think, what we call traditional actuarial work.
That will become a data issue then.
Yeah, it's about commercializing the data.
Thank you.
What job function does the typical client of Quantium have?
What job function?
Are they marketing? Are they sales? Are they board? Are they?
Yeah. They can be anyone. So from Woolworths, it's from the CEO down. We've done pieces of work largely, I guess, on the retail side. It's about the marketing person and or the loyalty card head, understanding a different view of what they already know from within their product. But that's one side of Quantium, so market delivery. On the insurance side, I think some of the other guys might be able to give but a better view, but it's more the pricing functions, but it's about integrating what are traditional areas, as Jack was just saying, and adding the data layer. We often, from small clients to large clients, it could be any touch point throughout the company. So it's quite hard to say this is the typical client for a centres kind of piece, it would be someone running the centre. Would that be correct, Dan?
Within the retail property world, with shopping centres, we deal with people, depending on how they're structured internally, we may have our first point of contact as being the research team, who sort of work with us to understand what we do and divulge that information so it is available to all parts of the business.
Mm.
In other cases, we might work directly with a shopping centre manager who is on site day to day, and we're teaching them about who is your customer, which you can get a layer of without just walking through the shopping centre. And in many other cases, we also work with marketing teams, and even the leasing managers as well, to understand who those tenants might be that they want to place in their centre.
And some of the more unlikely sort of sources of touchpoint contacts are actually PR people. We've done a number of projects with various public relations firms and retailers who then use that in their own PR, not even direct marketing.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Yes.
Actuaries have had a testy relationship over time with marketing people, it could generally be said.
Yeah.
And perhaps it's very good that marketing people who, in my experience, have typically operated without a fact base often, operated on intuition. Perhaps it's good that these people are being challenged. How have you found that process going? Because in some ways, you're quite a threatening person, I imagine.
Yeah, in some ways. In some industries as well, for example, in the retail property space, there's an established network of not necessarily marketing people, but sort of property consultants who have a gut understanding of what happens based on census and probably more observational information. We have come to that space and challenged it by saying we know exactly which people, where they live, how they shop in your shopping centre, what they do, and all of these things. But I think what we've found over time is rather than challenging the status quo and removing them, there's actually also a lot of knowledge stored within that layer of that marketing type person who has an intuitive understanding of the industry, possibly better than what the data can tell us. So in some ways, it's really about knowing that you need to collaborate. And taking that on board from their side as well as ours. So often we get the challenge of the property consultants getting quite out of their depth and viewing us as a threat. But I think the best results have come where we've worked with them and increasingly do so.
Yes, I think that's a very important point for actuaries to remember.
Yes.
I just wanted to check a presumption that I'm kind of making, is that all your information about what newspapers people read and how many children they have and that sort of thing is related to transactional credit card information, and that that's the effective source of a lot of the underlying analysis?
So for some of the analysis where we use quantium data, interestingly, you just mentioned two different things which come across two different data sources. What kind of magazines they read actually comes from the Woolworths EBR data source, and the NAB transactional information is across credit and debit cards, so electronic transactions. But again, the value is really in being able to combine both and understand it. But it is, yes.
So if you're going to a video company and you're looking at insight into their customer base, you don't know what newspaper they read unless you can join them up via some other.
Yes.
I was just wondering, because consumers are the ultimate generators of the data, but yet the data is being used, by companies obviously for commercial purposes, mainly, marketing purposes.
Yeah.
How are customers, benefiting from this other than, getting more targeted?
Well,
how could they benefit?
The first simplest example came to mind was when you get your everyday rewards emails from Woolies or perhaps from Coles, you actually get more relevant offers for yourself. But beyond that, I think it's if the targeted offers that come to you are more relevant, to you. That's in the personal contact space. But broader benefits to customers, I think it's a very general, you know, it's better for the economy that everyone works in a more competitive advantage here. But I don't think there's a specific benefit to a customer at a low level beyond getting better targeted offers.
Seems like it could be better used.
Do you sort of have any...
I feel like there could be some, I'm just sort of taking a stab in the dark, but there could be some uses in the health space, which is the first thing that comes to mind. We haven't looked in that area just yet. We are, there's some sort of opportunities there, and I think there's a whole area and industry that we haven't tapped into yet, even within the data sources we have at Quantium. And even working with government agencies to provide more efficient services to consumers. I think that's
actually a very good point. Like, we're starting to work with Australia Post to help them understand their networks better, which hopefully then should service everyone in the country better. So those sort of advancements. And then there's the concept of the slide I put up initially about picking up terrorists from the way they walk.
Just going to say, even taking Woolworths as an example, other than sort of better targeting, Woolworths would actually take that information to develop new offerings. So offerings that may exist only in a very niche market, well then customers will now, as a result of this analysis, be able to access better product offerings.
And I thought even if it's not product offerings, which is better email, which could access to users, it could even be, people who eat yogurt, buy pet food, they might start to offer more pet food or something. You know, there might be something to our advantage, but stores more easily laid out, and there are more pet food offerings than used to be before. There could be something like that that is not actually a marketing tool to you, but the store is trying to make it simpler for you to purchasing. I'm hoping that there's
absolutely. No, but store layouts are constantly, I think it's a continual piece that we and I'm sure every other store that works on this works on trying to make the layout simpler for customers to navigate and get in and out.
The other thing that would not change too much is the customer
You're using the NAB data to extrapolate for Australia as a wide. Is that risky?
I should take a step back really. There's a process that we don't use NAB data and just use it straight up. We undertake quite a bit of modelling where we actually make sure that it's representative of the Australian population. So we'll take the idea of the census at the most granular level possible to make sure that each NAB customer represents either 3, 4 or perhaps 10 of a number of customers in what we call an SA1, which is a sub-postcode geolocation. And make sure that we understand each age band by gender, basically by all the factors that we can relate to the census to make sure it's market representative so that it doesn't then incorporate NAB's own growth or deterioration in any given area. So there's
NAB's got 2 million customers?
NAB has some, I think, 20-25% of the market. What we work with is only the active customers so that we're not
people who ever use the NAB card for one transaction here and there. Over the years, you would have worked with different customers or different projects, etc. So you would have picked up a lot of data from different sources.
Yes.
But then, due to privacy reasons or commercial reasons, will not be. As in, when you produce an analysis, you will always just referring to one specific set of data at a time, right? So is that, in a way, limiting the content of your insight reports that you produce? Because you simply cannot borrow or use knowledge that you found from, say, working with a competitor.
Yeah.
Something like that.
No, that's very true. In terms of security protocols and privacy of information, And I guess business sensitivities, we obviously wouldn't use information that we gather from Woolworths for the benefit of a competitor. But what it does enable us to do is understand the different methods that can be used to analyze information. And I think, as I was saying, you know, the concept of dumb data, there can be a lot of data, but if the methodology of accessing the wisdom that's stored within isn't cultivated, then it's actually not that useful. So I think the real key advantage is to understand how to process those various bits of information. But yes, in terms of if we work with say a JB Hi-Fi, no, we can't use their loyalty card information to the benefit of someone else.
What do you see as the challenge working as an actuary or actual background and competing in this data scientist field now where everyone's coming from, you know, people coming from engineering, statistics, medicine, even IT, so everyone's coming in to say that this is the future,
we
all handle on it. People in IT said that we are, you know, we know how to handle big data.
Yeah.
So what are the challenges that you think that for this
for actuaries in
particular.
I actually think given the level of growth that's happening in the field, from the perspective of saying the challenge is how do we say we're better than an engineer or an IT consultant at doing this job, I don't think that even comes up because the requirement is growing probably more rapidly than the number of people entering various forms of big data space. And in terms of what do actuaries bring? I think the skill sets that we bring with the ability of, we're not programmers, but we understand how the broad level of how programming works. The nature of actuarial learning, I think, right from university is such that we are taught to commercialize more than someone with a pure maths or stats background. So I think in that regard, we're pretty well placed to handle those sort of challenges and then work with the other experts in various divisions. So, but I think that given the growth, I don't think proving our mettle as actuaries are better than anyone else is necessarily the way forward.
Yeah. Just to add to that, the one thing that actuaries bring that others don't bring is an ability to look at the data very thoroughly and make sure that only the proper data is used. You started to talk about this a minute ago with NAB. Actuaries have competed for years with statisticians, but what you tend to find is the statistician will, you know, do a good model, right degrees of freedom, all this sort of thing, just over the data, won't look properly at the data to see what data should be used, to assess the usefulness of the results, given the trends that are going on in the data. So we have a consciousness of the end product, and the one thing that we really do well, in my experience, is we choose the data well. I imagine that's something that is important in, you know, or perhaps it's not so much, perhaps you just analyse the...
No, I'd have to agree with that. Probably the biggest limitation with someone like Quantium, we have, I think, 100 or so people with actuarial backgrounds, compared to some of our competitors, is that we often find our own view is the biggest limitation, in that we'll look at something and apply actuarial reasonableness and say, look, you know, I don't think this should be done, or we can make this kind of conclusion, whereas a competitor is quite happy to go gung ho and, you know, make. So, in fact, if anything, that side of things is a limiting factor. And it's quite difficult to say X competitor isn't actually analysing things properly because that's not a professional thing to do. So, it's actually a limitation in a way. Great, thank you all very much. Very exciting bunch of questions. Thank you.